Hello and welcome to the Theology Mill podcast, which is brought to you by Wipfenstock Publishers. My name is Zach Mickle. I'm on staff here at Wipfenstock, and I'm also the host of this podcast, which consists of interviews with leading authors and thinkers in theology, biblical studies, and philosophy. If you like what you're hearing on this podcast, please also come on by our website, which you can find at wipfenstock.com. And on our website, you can browse our book catalog and also check out what we have going on our blog. So in this episode, I had the privilege of interviewing Michael Morelli, who is the assistant professor of theology, culture, and ethics at Northwest Baptist Seminary, which is in British Columbia, Canada. Michael is the editor of a recent 2023 Pickwick book called Desert, Wilderness, Wasteland, and Word. This volume includes the first ever English translation of an essay by Jacques Ellul, the French thinker, along with five short engagements with that essay of Ellul's from several current leading Ellul scholars. So you can find that book or find the link to that book in the show notes below. And with that, thank you so much for listening, and we really hope you enjoy this conversation. Okay, so I am here with Dr. Michael Morelli, who just published a new book with us at Pickwick. So he's the editor of this new volume, which is called Desert, Wilderness, Wasteland, and Word, a new essay by Jacques Ellul and five critical engagements. So it's actually a fresh or even a first English translation of this essay by Jacques Ellul, is that right?
Yeah, first English translation.
Okay, congratulations. That's awesome. And then sort of five essays from contemporary figures responding to it. So welcome, Michael. Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on. So you actually are on the Pacific Coast, right? Or you're Pacific Standard Time at least, right?
Yeah, Canadian Pacific Northwest. So
okay.
Broadly speaking in Vancouver, but in a particular sort of city within the greater Vancouver area called Langley.
Okay, got it. Okay.
Which to our listeners probably means nothing, but
right.
Basically it's like the other side of the border in the sense that it rains a lot. Sometimes yes. It's sunny and we like our, you know, local organic food, our single origin coffee and, you know, all that stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah, I've heard of Langley, so it's not strange to me, but I think this is maybe the second podcast episode I've done with someone who was in Pacific Standard Time. So I'm very grateful.
It's great.
We get to meet at a time that's convenient for me too. That's nice.
It is lovely actually that neither of us have to wake up super early to do this.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. You're probably used to it as well, I'm sure. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so we're sharing a drink. I have a chai tea that I just made at home with some oat milk in it. Yeah, I prefer teas in the afternoon. It's nothing fancy. I think it's just kind of a cheap brand that was like a stocking stuffer a couple years ago maybe, and I was low on tea, so this is what I'm drinking this afternoon, but it's keeping me awake and tastes not too bad. So I am enjoying
it. What's your oat milk of choice?
Oh gosh. I don't know if I'm that sophisticated about oat milks. I honestly got really into raw milk for a while there. Because it's the only dairy I can do that like doesn't upset my stomach. And it's freaking delicious. I don't know if you've ever tried it. It's like whole milk, but it's the texture to me is thicker and there's the cream on top and right. So it sweetens whatever you're drinking a ton,
right?
without any artificial sugar in it.
Yeah.
But I mean, as far as oat milk, I don't have any, I try to get ones that are relatively low in sugar. I did one time get sugar-free oat milk and it tasted like I was like drinking. It reminded me of like when you overcook oatmeal and it gets like that kind of soggy burntish oat flavor almost, like that's how it tastes to me, and I just could not enjoy it.
Yeah. Because I'm also an oat milk user, as it were, and I definitely have ones that I like better than others. And my go-to is the sort of bulk by Costco brand.
The Kirkland. Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's pretty good. Because there's other ones like Silk. It's type, you know, it's low in sugar, but you're like, the Costco stuff is low in sugar, but it's much creamier than the Silk stuff. Or Earth's Own is another good one, but that's a little pricier. Okay. That's a little bit too top shelf oat milk for me.
top shelf oat milk.
I haven't had raw milk. I tried lactose free milk, but that didn't work super well, because apparently, like, you can take the lactose out, but there's other things in there that'll still hurt you if you have lactose challenges. I'm a Costco guy, Kirkland brand.
Okay. Yeah. Strutting that with some pride. I was just at Costco yesterday, had to resist the chicken bake, which is always very, very tempting. I went with a hot dog because it's a little gentler on my system, so I was proud of myself.
It's like
the like 149 hot. I have a wife and a daughter, and I think we all ate for like $8.
Oh yeah. It's like IKEA, you know?
Yeah.
You get what you need and you get a relatively filling, not necessarily wholesome meal.
Yes.
For you,
that's right.
Family. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you? What are you drinking?
I'm drinking a pretty boring Keurig coffee done by President's Choice. But I just want to note for our listeners that it is it's 100% compostable Keurig cup. Not the ones that say they're recyclable, but you have to take off the tinfoil and like put the plat. This is 100% compostable, and that's important to me that people know that.
Okay. Is this like a high-end cure? I don't know. Are there high-end Keurig coffee brands?
Yeah, there are.
The only Keurig coffees I've had were not good. So.
Yeah, I work in academia and in theology in particular. So I don't have a large budget for fancy Keurig cups. So. I tend to buy, you know, the President's Choice, but they're pretty good, actually. On top of being affordable, they're pretty good.
Nice.
You know, the ideal is, you know, the fresh ground stuff, but we don't have that at my work, so just correct.
Yeah. You got to go with what you have at work, and in my experience, it's typically not the best options ever.
Well, that's like, the workplace. I think there are foods and beverages that, you know, depending on the circumstances, it'll work. Coffee and pizza are like that for me. It's like, do you want pizza or coffee? The answer is always yes. And what's available.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, sometimes bad pizza or bad coffee is all that's available. And in that case, it's good because it's there.
Right. And it's still coffee or pizza. So even if it's bad, I mean, maybe some people would shoot me for saying this, but even if it's bad, it's still pretty dang good. Like, I don't know. That's sort of my opinion.
When you're on a road trip and you're tired and all you got is bad gas station coffee or, you know, Tim Hortons or McDonald's or Dunkin' Donuts coffee.
Yeah.
I'm very Canadian there and saying Tim Hortons. It works. It'll do. Yeah. Right. So. Yeah. Yeah, I don't care what the coffee snobs say.
That's right. If you could have access to Jacques Ellul's correspondence with two other thinkers, who would you choose and why? So if you want a second to think on it,
question. Well, number one, right off the bat, I would say Paul Virilio. Virilio may come up in our discussions, but my doctoral research looked at the relationship between the two thinkers and actually explored and connections that people haven't really explored, or even just intertextual dialogue that either was explicit or implicit And so I did discover some kind of correspondence indirectly. Vrilia was 20 years younger than Olul, but very influenced by him. And so one of the things I wanted to explore was if the influence definitely went one way, but I wanted to see if Olul, because they were both situated in 20th century France, whether the Olul took notice of Vrilio and engaged with him at all. And so I found in Olul's book, Technological Bluff, I found a quote. It's so esoteric doctoral research stuff, but I found this quote that was from Le Monde magazine that quoted an interview with Vrilio, but the editor, the original French editor, and the English translator and editor, none of them properly cited the interview. And I remember looking for 2 years for evidence in every single Lowell book that there was engagement. Wow. And I finally found it buried in this book. And I remember like calling my wife on the phone, being like, I found it. And she knew it was so important to me that she started crying and like, I'm crying. Then I text my friend, Jacob Rollison, who is another Lowell scholar, office mate, really good friend. And I text him, I'm like, I found it. And I'm pretty sure there was some swear words in it. We just celebrated. So, and then later when I traveled to Bordeaux to actually spend some time with Olul's grandson, Jerome, and spend some time in their, the Olul family country house, which is like their getaway in Mont-de-Marsan, where their archives are. I found other correspondence where there was another contemporary thinker who sent a letter to Olul with another interview of Vrilio. It was like, there's this young up and comer. Oh, wow. Olul, like, you got to check him out. He's awesome. And Olul had read it and like highlighted bits of the interview. And so those were kind of my smoking guns. But I want to continue to look for more. So I don't even know if more exists, but if it does, that would be my first. The second, I would probably say it would be a tie between, could I have it be a round table correspondence between him, Karl Marx, Karl Barth, and Soren Kierkegaard? Because those were his three,
yes, of
three
course,
influences.
Of course.
So just to get him around the table and to see what happens would be pretty amazing. Or if they had some sort of, I don't know, iMessage conversation or WhatsApp group or letter exchange, something like that, that would be pretty amazing. So,
Yeah. It's always fun to think about in sort of off the cuff conversation, how the communication would be different, how things like sarcasm and humor, or maybe things they wouldn't write publicly, maybe little, takes on politics or whatever that they wouldn't come out with publicly. Kind of stuff would be so fascinating.
Especially with Olul, because I don't know if you've read much, if any, of his writing, which is fine if you haven't, but Olul is not a hot take guy. He is the opposite. He's a cold take guy. And I think he is very disciplined as a sociologist and historian. He never wants to get carried away with statements about the way the world is or the way the world was or the way the world could be. He comes across as very austere. But I think behind that is actually a very creative and interesting and probably pretty funny and sarcastic guy. The one book that really gets it is his book, Critique of the Commonplaces. He actually gets pretty funny in that. But beyond that, he's pretty unflinching and cold. So to see him goof around a little bit would be actually pretty fun.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, that's actually a bit surprising because I mean, I, yeah, I have not read a lot of Elul, but my impression of him, of course, is that he's got this pretty trenchant critique of technology, and then that he's an anarchist. Like, right, these are kind of the mainstays of like the popular understanding of Elul. So I sort of imagine him as this like fiery hot take kind of guy.
Yeah.
So that's actually a bit surprising to me.
Yeah. Well, he's definitely fiery, but it's a particular kind of fire. And yeah, definitely, you know, known as the guy who is one of the first sort of enduring critics of modern technology. And a lot of people know him because of his book, Anarchy and Christianity. And so, yeah, I mean, he was definitely passionate, but I think, and this was kind of a reaction to his sort of contemporary setting, is that he lived in Bordeaux in protest against this idea at the time, was that you couldn't be an intellectual if you weren't in Paris. And so he kind of stands apart, which is why he's often read in a bit of a vacuum, even though it's really helpful when you situate him in that wider scene where a lot of amazing, you know, German and French thought emerge, you know, during and after the Second World War. The way that Elul writes, he can be a little bit distant from that in his voice, and because he's not like, like he's a bit older than that sort of, you know, structuralist, post-structuralist crowd. Yeah, so when Foucault gets popular, it's his students that are talking to him about it. So he reads it and he's like, what is this? This isn't history, right? Like, this isn't history at all. This is what is this nonsense, right? Because he was a historian and like legal historian by trade, as it were. So yeah, he's much more disciplined in his fire than some of the other ones. Like Virilio is totally different. He's unhinged and frenetic and fragmentary. And so and that has a particular type of, you know, warmth or scorch to it, as it were. But Yeah, Elul's kind of, he's like when I was looking at some of the questions you sent to me, it reminded me that I often say that Elul's kind of like the French Theodore Adorno.
Okay.
If you've ever read Adorno. Yeah. You know, there's that iconic image of Adorno, like thumbs down. You know, whatever it is, I don't like it. Like if it's popular, it's probably bad. You know, the saying of Groucho Marx is, I don't know, whatever it is, I don't like it. Like, or I don't trust it. Yeah. Like, that's Elul's like first inclination is no.
That's funny. That's really funny.
Yeah. So yeah, life of the party.
Bit of a crotchety figure, maybe then.
yeah, exactly.
Okay, so let's move into talking a little bit about Jacques Ellul's life, his thought. I know we got to talk about whose correspondence you would like to see, but tell me a little bit about Jacques Ellul for our listeners who aren't familiar with him.
Sure. Yeah, he was a Protestant French sociologist, theologian, and activist who did most of his writing during the 20th century, mid to late 20th century. And he actually grew up really, really poor. He came from aristocratic roots, but because his father valued honor above everything else, he was repeatedly fired from his jobs for choosing honor over, you know, consistent employment. His father was a wine merchant. And so from an early age, Elul actually had to work to support his family, teaching languages and tutoring as other students. And so right from the get-go, he was an incredibly gifted individual. I mean, who knows German, French, and Latin that early? Elul did. So he spoke, read, and taught from a really early age, and he devoured history books, and by the age 18 he had read like all of Marx's work and Kierkegaard's works. So he was pretty brilliant and driven right from the start. And so when he finished school, he actually wanted to go into the Navy. He was always interested in boats and water. And that was kind of a thing for his family as well, just living, you know, where he did in France near the water and so forth. But his dad said, no, you're not going into the Navy. You're going to go to university and you're going to study law and you're going to be a lawyer. So Alul listened to his dad, but he chose to specialize in Roman law because he loved history. And so he kind of he didn't trick his dad because he still sort of studied law, but he ended up studying Roman law, which factors in a very interesting way into his work, actually. Like, his first book is called Theological Foundation of Law. And it's a really interesting text. It actually got interest from Bart. Bart was pretty excited about it when he had read it. It's like, imagine somebody reading the scriptural letter to the Romans with a deep knowledge of Roman law, and you're kind of getting at Alul. But through all this, you know, he got his doctorate and he ended up teaching in history and sociology of institutions at the University of Bordeaux after the Second World War. But before the war, he was actually teaching at the University of Strasbourg and was fired from his post for speaking out against the Vichy regime. A student reported him. And around that same time, it was discovered that his wife was not officially a French citizen. And his father as well was discovered for not being an official French citizen. It just was different back then. It's like, you didn't really bother, to go through some of that stuff, right? So his father ended up being imprisoned and died in prison. But the Alul family got away to the unoccupied zones in France. And they lived there during the war. He learned how to farm to support his family. He taught classes by correspondence. He worked on a doctorate in theology that he never finished because of the circumstances. But he also participated in the French resistance. So he and his wife provided refuge for people who were fleeing the National Socialists. And they forged papers for them and actually helped transport them across the border into Spain. So he actually received awards and medals for the work that he did in the resistance during the war. After the war, he was hired at the University of Bordeaux and he lived there and taught and, you know, did his activism for the rest of his life. And he wrote a ton. There's about 60 published books out there of his, and about 1,000 articles with more still being discovered and published, including the essay that is the sort of centerpiece of this book. So that's kind of a picture of who he was. Oh, and the only other thing I would mention is that he kind of grew up with Catholicism and spent some time in the Catholic Church for a while, but didn't feel like that was where he ultimately was at home. And so he ended up actually in the smaller Protestant Reformed Church in France. I think the discovering Calvin, a lawyer who also happened to be a theologian, was appealing to him given his background. But he also said that he felt like he could make more of a lasting change in the smaller Reformed Church. So, just to situate it a little bit, this connects him with the personalist movements in France. So there was a Protestant side and there was a Catholic side. And these were a group of, you know, Protestants and Catholics who were really concerned in the early 20th century about, you know, technological advancement and the sort of shadow side of modernity that other people weren't seeing. So he was embedded in that wider group and wrote with the various journals and was engaged in the type of like ecology activism before that was a thing. Like, he was part of the OG ecologists, as it were. So that kind of gives you an idea of who this this guy was.
Sure. Yeah. No, thank you for that. So he was a historian by training. And then also you're saying also did kind of the coursework for a PhD in theology.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So a lot of people, you know, on the English side of his readership and publishing just describe him as a sociologist. But I kind of say he's a sociologist and historian on the one hand, but a theologian and a ethicist on the other. But he's most known, I think up until now, there's kind of two waves of Elul scholars. There's kind of a mid to late 20th century wave. And then there's a newer wave represented by some of the people who are doing essays in this book and a lot of other Elul scholars who are sort of discovering his work and the value of it. Mm-hmm. But he and a lot of them are saying you can't understand his sociology without understanding his theology and vice versa. But generally he's known as a sociologist in the way that, you know, you would call somebody like Roland Barthes a sociologist. Like, what that means in the sort of continental 20th century context means a very interdisciplinary, broad and deep thing, which to me is awesome. It's not as constricted by the sort of rigid, sort of specialized disciplines that sometimes we can get caught up in.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Okay. So what were kind of the main topics that he wrote on?
Yeah. So very broadly, like sociology, history, theology, and ethics. I was saying earlier that I kind of think of him as a one-man Frankfurt school in his sociological and historical work.
That's because awesome.
It kind of occurred to me. I was like, wow, he's doing in his own work what the Frankfurt school was doing with his group of amazing sort of motley crew of critical theorists, philosophers, sociologists, and psychoanalysts and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So out of all of them, I think he's most similar to Theodor Adorno. In fact, in one of his books on modern art, he quotes Adorno quite a lot and quite glowingly. In some ways, he's a messianic Marxist, if you will. but he always said, he's like, I'm not a Marxist in the sense that he's like, I'm a Christian. And Marx said, you know, to enter my work, you have to leave your faith behind. But he's very influenced by Marx's method. So on the theological side, though, he's influenced by Kierkegaard and Barth. Those are his, you know, two sort of main influences. Yeah. So if you combine that with the Marx influence, he's dialectical through and through, and so dialectical that he split his work into two streams, the sociology and history on the one side and the theology and ethics on the other. So in doing that, you have this thinker who is really precise and penetrating in his analysis of all the determinative socio-cultural, political, and economic institutions and forces in the 20th century. On the one hand, or you could just say modernity on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you have this Kierkegaardian, Barthian response to those determinative institutions and forces. So almost a prophetic proclamation of the presence of God, who overturns all of that and calls people to a life of freedom with Jesus Christ. So that's a big question for Elul scholars, is how do you read these two streams of his work in conversation to really create the type of transformation, the dialectical transformation that he wanted to create in his work, but not force or put out there or sort of synthesize just by writing, you know, in one stream. So that's a thing that Elul scholars like to talk about. And I have my own thoughts on how to do that, but that may be a rabbit trail we don't want to
I do want to go on that rabbit trail. No, that's super interesting to me, because I have a lot of respect for the Frankfurt School and critical theory, especially like it's the early days of it. Like you said, Adorno, Horkheimer, Marcuse, though, I think is especially really, really interesting. But then I also I also really respect these like really Christocentric kind of orthodox theologians like Barth and Hans-Urs von Balthasar. And I don't know that I don't know that I personally have ever encountered a thinker who sort of relates those two styles of thinking to each other in a way that's not oppositional or yes. like defensive. But I've not read much of Jacques Ellul. So now you have me captivated. Now I want to know how he relates those.
I'm glad because honestly, the reason why I think more people don't write him is read him is because he wrote so much. So, mm-hmm. and then of course, as interesting and, at times as elegant as this method was of separating his work into two streams, it doesn't do a lot to make your work accessible.
Yeah, sure.
I think, you know, my PhD supervisor, who also supervised my friend Jake Rowlandson, who did his doctoral research on Ellul, just said, yeah, you know, what you're doing, you and Jake are doing is all the reading of Ellul and then just telling us and others, not just Jake and I, but others of, you know, you're doing all the reading of Ellul so that the rest of us don't have to.
Yeah.
And that's really kind of, you know, what I was trying to do in my book is to say, hey, here's why it's worth considering a person like Ellul or Paul Breuillet as not separate from this thing that we call the Christian tradition, but a part mm-hmm. of it. They may be marginal, but their gift is that they're conversant with some of these schools that other theologians that are bigger names and more read in theological circles, because they're conversant in some of these other schools of thought, but they weave in theology, it really gives you so much for those of us who want to do theology today in a way that's critical and constructive. So,
yeah, for sure. So in his critique of things like technology and capitalism, is he sort of critiquing those things as such, like at a really kind of abstract philosophical distance, or does he actually kind of get into sort of the implications of like living under, you know, technocracy and capitalism?
Yeah.
Like, does he actually kind of get into the psychology of what the experience of living in those conditions is like?
More so the latter. He actually really performatively, at least, eschewed philosophy. Sometimes people refer to him as a philosopher, but he would have been uncomfortable with that term because for him, philosophy was too abstract. He wanted to use a Marxist structural analysis to say, you know, what are the sort of mid-level institutions and forces and laws that are determining in our society for better or for worse. And so mm-hmm. he doesn't get into, you know, abstract metaphysics, and he doesn't get too caught up in surface phenomena. He wants to get into that structural layer of what are the real things that are kind of determining us from the individual to the institutional to the societal level. Yeah. And so, you know, his big thesis, jumping from Marx, is he asked the question, if Marx were alive in the 20th century, what would he designate as the new capital? And Ellul's answer to that question is technique. So in short form, the thesis is that initially capital was sort of the dominant force, but there's a threshold that's crossed at some point where in order for capital to expand and circulate continually, it needs technique. So technique or technology, although it needs capital to get off the ground, after a while, capital relies on technology to get to where it's always trying to go. And And so that's his sort of hermeneutic for the modern world, as it were. And that we'll probably get into as we get into his work on the desert, is what produces the really nasty stuff that we see happening, all throughout the 20th century, and then, right through into the 21st century in terms of exploitation of people, the environment, violence, war, division, all these things, malaise. It's because of that, and other things, but that is the real thing that is, or phenomenon that is producing the problems. And yet we're addicted to it because it provides comfort, it provides affluence, it provides power. And so even though it threatens us, it also promises to save us. And so that, I say, is basically the sociological way of talking about idolatry theologically. Right? Like idols hand out power, comfort, all that control, as long as you bow down to them. And then in the end, your bowing down will end you. But it's the appeal, the seduction of the power, the wealth, and all that control that causes you to bow down. And Alul says that that's this ever, moving relationship between technique and capital.
Yeah, absolutely. Were there particular sort of, historical situations in his life that he's kind of trying to respond to in his work? Or like, were there any sort of watershed moments in his personal life that really shifted his work or marked his work in important ways?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think for him, for so many of these other thinkers that are being read still today because of the prescience of their analysis, and by thinkers, that are being read, I mean these continental German and French thinkers. It's honestly the atrocities of the wars that they underwent that really terrified them and pushed them to think about, like, how did we get here? Like, after the Holocaust, after Auschwitz, after the Hiroshima and Nagasaki, how did we get to that, and how do we never get back to that again? And so in Alul's own life, that works its way out in a number of ways in terms of watershed moments. But he describes being a kid, during the First World War, and what it was like seeing soldiers, go off to war. But also too, when he becomes an adult and the First World War ends and things are starting to really boil, he's seen essentially the rise of fascism, and he's trying to stop it. And so he talks about being invited actually to a National Socialist rally across the border in Germany at one point, and he's invited by Christians, at least in name. So he attends out of curiosity, because he's, a sociologist who's like, what's going on here? I want to figure out what's going on. I want to figure out how to respond to it. And so he goes with a few of his friends, and he's sitting there, and he talks about this in an interview at the end of his life. He said, it was so terrifying seeing how people could be whipped up into a frenzy so easily, with the loudspeakers, the banners, the speeches, all the performative stuff that you would expect at a rally like that, and that we see in modern politics all the time since then. And he said, when people were, doing the Nazi salute, the whole crowd did it. And he said it was really hard to not do it. And he didn't, but he was really shaken by the sort of, honestly, like, power, the spiritual power, and how that affects the physical in a moment like that, where you lose control, you become one with the mass, and you're subscribing to hateful things that lead to violence, and that you're like, your literal body is controlled by that. So mm-hmm. it's moments like that. And also a lot of things that he probably didn't even talk about. Virilio, on the other hand, talks about it openly, but I think Alul dealt with the trauma of what he went through just by not talking about it. Going through his archives, I did have the opportunity to do that, and discovering like some of his poetry, because he wrote poetry, and it's actually pretty good. You know, sometimes it's like, oh, this theologian wrote fiction or poetry, and it's like, good thing only their theology is published. Like, poetry is actually good. I came across one poem that actually, a few poems that were, the more I read them, the more I realized that they were that, that was how he processed the trauma. So he talked about, you know, his family being, you know, by some creek or river, and some bomb or explosion happened, and it was near the home that they didn't happen to be in. But then he talks about, like, here's what could have happened if, say, my kids were sleeping in their beds, or like, you know, we were in the kitchen, and that sort of thing. So a lot of these folks, the reason why they come across as so alarmist and austere at points is because they don't want to see fascism take over. They don't want to see more atrocities, and they're doing everything they can to stop it. And those experiences is where that comes from.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so in what ways could Alul kind of speak to our world today? Like, what, or maybe another way to phrase that would be like, what do you think that we need to hear from Alul's oeuvre? Like, what do we really need to heed in his thought?
Well, there's lots I could say, but the first thing that comes to mind would be his work on freedom. He wanted to do a major work on Christian ethics of faith, hope, and love. And corresponding to that, different ethics that would grow out of it. But he didn't end up writing all of them, but he ended up prioritizing the one on hope, and the corresponding freedom that comes out of hope. And so, because he felt like the message of freedom was the most important message for the modern world. And that message is, I think, pretty prophetic because he says that true freedom in Jesus Christ, is actually terrifying, hard, and essential work. So I'm paraphrasing him in Ethics of Freedom, but he says, you know, all this talk about freedom, you got to remember that, like, in this universe, you got Jean-Paul Sartre, who's talking about freedom and being born with innate freedom, right? Mm-hmm. And Alul's like, no, no. All this talk about freedom makes it seem like we're born with it, that it's this innate attribute, but it isn't. That he says freedom, and you can get Barton Kierkegaard here, right? Mm-hmm. Freedom's an offering from the God who liberated Israel from captivity, right? The God who comes to us in Jesus Christ and asks us sincerely, do you want to get well? So from history, the present, and probably the future, he says, like, we learn that most often when people are offered freedom, they actually don't spring forward in joy. They actually jump back in fear and retreat into what's familiar, right? They retreat back mm-hmm. into bondage. So mm-hmm. Israel is an example. They've seen all these miracles of God getting them out of slavery in Egypt, and now they're in the desert wandering in the promised land. And the minute that trouble hits, even though God is giving them freedom actively, like, they want to go back to slavery mm-hmm. Back to the comfort and familiarity that, even though it's brutal, you know, hey, we had meat pots. It's like, no, you didn't. And also, you were in slavery. But that's us, right? So that's the point that he's making, is that actually to live liberated, to live free, is actually a very difficult and terrifying thing. So if you look at what's going on in North America today, you know, Christianity in general, evangelical alignment in particular with brutal politics, then you start to see why Alul is such a critical thinker, writer, and activist for our time, right? Like, freedom is thrown around so much, but it's like, what are we willing to bind ourselves to, enslave ourselves to, in order to get this illusory freedom? And I'm putting that in quotes because it's not freedom at all.
Yeah. No, that's really good. Yeah. I'm curious, would you say that he's sort of a messianic thinker? Like, is there sort of a, because the way you were talking made it almost sound like there has to be this divine inbreaking that we have to like wait on in order for us to be free. So, I mean, does he have kind of some of those messianic impulses?
Yes. Yeah. And it depends at what stage in his life, how that works its way out. So at the start of his career, his, you know, inbreaking messianism is very much like, it's here, right? And so a good introductory point into that and his work as a whole is his book, Presence in the Modern World. But in the 70s, and I mentioned him earlier, he's another Alul scholar and friend, Jacob Rawlinson, who also contributes to the Desert book, looks at this at length in his own book on Alul, Presence in the Postmodern World. But in the 70s, Alul is trying to create change at every level in his writing, in the churches that he's a part of, in his activism. Even he was involved in the World Council of Churches, and he's just the sort of prophet that nobody's listening to. And so he loses his friend, a couple, you know, really demoralized, like best friend, a couple of really hard things happen in his life, and he kind of snaps. And he writes a book called Hope in Time of Abandonment. And then it becomes the other type of messianic inbreaking, a waiting in hope beyond all hope that God will appear and no longer be silent. And he says that he realizes that God has turned away, at least at the sort of societal level, the global level, that God has turned away and is silent and no longer speaking anymore, because we, even if God were speaking, that nobody would be listening. And he says that maybe God is still speaking to certain individuals, but as far as Alul can tell, at the sort of wider level, nobody's listening. Mm-hmm. And so what then do you do? Well, you let go of everything that you're putting your hope in, and you wait in anticipation for God to start speaking again, for God to be present again. So, and some people think that that's a sincere shift, and others think that it's more of a performative shift to sort of provoke a reaction to say, no, like, assuredly God is not silent, right? Like, he's here, he's never left, right? And I like to read him in the latter way, but most people think that he really did sort of snap and felt like that. And maybe he did at points, but I feel like he's trying to provoke that reaction to earnestly see God and trust that despite all appearances, the Messiah has come and is still here and is with us till the end of the age.
I'd be interested to, like, it seems like one of the dangers of messianism is that I've heard people talk about how, like, messianism has a danger of, like, being too open to totalitarianism in a way, because it can have this sort of passive tone to it, I guess. So I'm curious if with Alul, if his sort of messianic bent has any kind of like concrete or active manifestation, especially like in kind of the political, ethical realm. Like, how does he recommend we actually act as political agents?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a great critical question that people would put towards this this type of theology and what type of ethic it produces. And I think that's where Alul's anarchy comes into play and his activism comes into play, that and his type of anarchism is a particular kind where he kind of says that it's a form of socialism in the sense it's anarcho-syndicalism. So it's this idea that you wouldn't have a sort of centralized state that everybody's relying on, but you would have localized bodies of people doing politics, and then they would come together at points and do politics together, representing their locality. So, but that's a bit of a rabbit trail. But the point being is that his type of waiting in anticipation is not inaction. It's action that does not trust whatever the world is offering to solve the problems that we're dealing with, right? So, so if anybody or anything comes to you saying, hey, you know, I got the solution here, or just, you know, support this structure and it'll solve the problem, watch out, right? And so that's the, he never stops his activism. In fact, it pushes him further into it. He, on top of his ecological activism, he worked a lot with really marginalized, disaffected youth in Bordeaux. And, you know, for some fun reading, there's some crazy stories that he tells about the predicaments that he and his colleagues found himself in working with these kids. But that for him was what you do while you're waiting for God to start speaking again, is you spend time in relationship with people, and you go to the places where everybody would say God's not there, but that's precisely where God would be. And you know, essentially, whenever there is an appearance of God, it seems to be the case that it's not reinforcing, you know, the structures that humans build and the principalities and powers that are, you know, at the bedrock of those. It normally is an overthrow of those things that that happens when God shows up.
Sure.
So that's the kind of, well, this we'll probably get into it later, but that's the type of apocalyptic messianism that Alul is about, is when God shows up, it represents an overthrow, or it affects an overthrow of systems of power. And in unlikely ways, sometimes in ways that the world will look and say, that's not power, but that's precisely the power of God.
Fascinating. Yeah, that's really, really fascinating. Okay, so then how did you discover Alul? Like, how did you start reading him?
Yeah, when I think back, it was probably in my undergrad at Simon Fraser University here in Vancouver. I did my bachelor's in English and communications, and I was interested in literature and media, and the media school at the time was assigning to, you know, first and second year undergrads people like Alul and Adorno and Benjamin and Foucault and like Lyotard and Baudrillard, you know, like all of them, Marx. And I mean, I understood like 10%, but the 10% I understood was like being given a hermeneutic for the world around me. It was like I finally had a way to understand what I felt was wrong. Right? Yeah. It's just like there's the Wizard of Oz curtain, and then the curtain falls and you see the little people pulling the levers, and people like Alul helped me do that. And then, you know, I bumped along, I finished my undergrad, I was working as a barista, and ended up being led into local church ministry as a worship arts pastor, and then later as a communications director. And so I went to seminary at the time to do my homework, as it were, for that work. And And along the way, doing work in worship arts and communications, I just started running into questions that I didn't feel like I could answer in the field, because this was in the early 2000s where the megachurch phenomenon was really gaining speed and in a different way than the sort of like late 90s Willow Creek way, like situated where we are in the Pacific Northwest, Mars Hill Church, yeah, and yeah, other churches like it were the sort of paragon of success. If you were a young guy in ministry in Pacific Northwest, like most people were striving to be that. And given my background in, you know, this sort of stuff, I always was kind of drawn to it, but also felt discontent. And so the door opened up for me to do further research. And so I took that opportunity at the University of Aberdeen. And initially, I didn't think that I was going to study Ahul or Virilio. Mm-hmm. I was just interested in Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer studies was really strong at Aberdeen at the time and still is. But over time, in conversation with Brian Brock and then Mike Mawson, it's just like, no, I probably should do something in the area of technology, and Ahul and Virilio were the clear choice for that. So that's kind of the journey. But the original encounter with Ahul was way back when. And I remember one time in seminary, his former prof, he's now a friend, Ray Aldred, he teaches at Vancouver School of Theology. I remember him mentioning Ahul in a class once, and the way that he said Ahul, there was a degree of respect and sort of weight to the way that he said Ahul. It's like, oh, I got to get back into Ahul. And that was kind of into like, oh, there's the theological stuff as well. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm a little jealous because I wish that my freshman year professors would have assigned me to assign our class as Ahul. And
I don't know. I mean, I'd be interested to go back and see what the communication school is now. I honestly doubt that it probably is what it was then, because you know, people are probably, you know, pushing for career outcomes, and doubt that, you know, I actually remember graduating and I tried to get hired at a marketing firm, and the guy said, can you give me a sample of your writing? So I gave him one of these like Frankfurt School-esque critique essays I wrote on Tumblr. And needless to say, I did not get a call back. He was like, I can't get this guy to sell anything. He's going to be a thorn in my side. So I was totally unemployable, but in God's sovereignty, 10 years later or so, when it came time to do a PhD, it was like all that came in handy. So thank you, SFU. You really did me a solid. I actually have emailed profs and said, hey, you know, look at me now. Like, you know, if you're having a hard day, you know, just know that upstart kid, like, you know, that you assigning Giorgio Agamben, or like giving us readings from, you know, Marx, like it actually did something. You know, email your teachers, folks, and tell them how you turned out. They need it.
Totally, for sure. Okay, let's actually turn to your book that just published a few months ago, on the desert, this essay by Ahul. Could you tell me a little bit about it? What was kind of the genesis of the project? What sort of interested you in taking it up?
So it started with a conversation with a colleague at Trinity Western University. Her name's Kelsey Haskett, and she translated the essay. And so I just started working at Northwest Seminary and College, which is a part of Trinity, and I showed up to the first faculty retreat, and Kelsey and I had met at a Ahul conference. It was the year before or something like that, because she's translated some of Alul's poetry and did really great job and presented on it. So we kind of reconnected at that conference, and we were eating lunch, and she just said, "Hey, I'm working on this new translation project, and you know, if you want, you can come on and co-edit it, just given, you know, your background in Alul." So of course I was like, "Yeah." Mm-hmm. And so then I jumped on, and so we started moving on it, but then a few things happened, most notably a global pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I actually got really sick, and I've had Crohn's disease since I was 18 years old, and you know, right after my second child was born, I had a flare up of Crohn's that put me in the hospital, emergency surgery and so forth. And it's wow. Kelsey's story to share on her side, but she actually got really sick as well. And I share that because I remember thinking at one point, I'm like, this project is cursed. Anybody who touches it is like stricken. not to be all spiritual or whatever, but I don't know. Sometimes things happen. You think, okay, combine that with a pandemic, you're like something, and you know, desert wilderness stuff. You're like, this is all coalescing. But anyways, after about 3.5 years of, you know, working on it, it's been published, and the essay is engaging with it. But the original manuscript was discovered by Jerome Alul's grandson, and a great scholar by the name of Jean-Philippe Cadry, who they found it in the Alul archives and edited and got it ready for publication in the French, which is a part of a book called Vivre et penser la liberté, or Live and Think Freedom. It's like a massive book that kind of collects all of Alul's writings on freedom. Yeah. So after that was done, we wanted to translate into English and do some essays that would engage it to really mm-hmm. bring it to life. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the genesis and the alpha and omega of it.
Awesome. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in your introduction to that book, you describe this essay by Alul as, quote, a unique encounter with the prolific Alul in his most apocalyptic style. So I'm curious what you mean there when you use the word apocalyptic.
Yeah. Well, very simply, I would say that for Alul and a lot of the people who contributed pieces to this volume, when we say apocalyptic, I think the idea is that whenever God shows up, you know, this holy other God shows up and is and decides to reveal God's self, that everything paradoxically becomes totally clear and unclear at the same time, or totally hopeful and terrifying at the same time. And as Alul puts it, just to read a bit of a quote here, he says, "From the moment we stop trying to understand this God or build a coherent theology, the only possible relationship is worship. It's a kind of worship that's a humbling of the mind, knowledge, and philosophy, an entering into worship that becomes the opening of the self to the one who we recognize without knowing." So a good concrete example that he gives is he talks about the pillar of cloud and fire that guides Israel through the desert, and how God's presence with those things in the desert, they reveal who God is, and they provide for Israel, they guide Israel, and they bring hope, but they're also opaque and mysterious, and they're even scary, right? So like the fire is burning at night, and it's bringing light, and it's bringing warmth, right, in the dark and the cold, but it's still a massive pillar of fire that the light only presumably shines so far. Mm-hmm. Right. Likewise, during the day, there's this massive cloud that actually dims the light in the desert, like the heat, mm-hmm. but it also obscures vision. right? So it's a visual reference point that provides cover and it helps them get through the desert, but it's also a cloud, so you can't mm-hmm. really see through it. And so that's the kind of unveiling but covering that happens in this apocalyptic sense of, yeah, it's like you realize everything and nothing at the same time. You're totally shattered and totally joined to something at the same time. So Owl, as I said before, he loved Bart, you know, mm-hmm. early, middle, and late. But I think here you kind of see him in that world of the early apocalyptic, you know, commentary on the Romans type stuff. Mm-hmm. So that kind of stuff, or I have in mind, I mean, I quote Hans Ulrich, theologian who talks a bit about it in the intro to sort of set the scene, but also Phil Ziegler's really wonderful book, Militant Grace, is another extended definition of apocalyptic. And so I'm aware that certain biblical scholars aren't a fan of that way of mm-hmm. interpreting apocalyptic, but personally, I think it is not only wonderful, I also think it's scriptural. So that's mm-hmm. kind of what mm-hmm. I mean, and I think what others are getting at when we're using the word, but also in the way that we're writing. Like, you know, we are writing this during lockdowns and a pandemic where it's uncertain, yeah. and you know, all the really rough and anger and sadness inducing events that happened politically and socially at that time. Like, I feel like mm-hmm. this was kind of therapeutic for all of us to just get on the keyboard, like try our very best to be a voice calling out in the desert, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what we're channeling in the book.
Mm, yeah. Okay. So carrying on with that thread, how does Elul use this word desert in his essay? Like, what does he really mean by desert? What all is entailed, like, when he's talking about the desert?
Yeah. I'll just sort of quote him directly here, because I think he puts it pretty well. He would say that in this essay, he says that biblical texts show us the desert as an essentially ambiguous place. So it's both good and bad. It's good because it's the place to which God sends people, or people encounter God, but at the same time, it's bad because it's a place of absence or deprivation, void, and chaos, right? So after Jesus is baptized, right, he goes into the desert and doesn't eat for 40 days, and it's a place of temptation and formation, and it, in that sense, it's really difficult, but it's also the place of presence through all of that. So it's the place of like total removal of all worldly things and total vulnerability to whatever forces are out there when we remove them, including God, but also some pretty bad stuff too, right? And so every time, you know, Israel's in the desert, good and awful things happen, right? Anything could happen in there. So Elul would say, again quoting him, that it's the place of our weakness, you know, absence of food, place of solitude, but it's also the place of our inaction, our initiative, our conquest, point of departure for human adventure. So you could say that you know, for Elul and his reading of scripture and application of it to the modern world, the desert's not a place, like a geographical location, as like a place with sand dunes or cacti or, you know, little to no water or food. It's more of a state. Like, it's a place in which an individual group already is or taken to, where a metaphorical and literal desert exists and has to be navigated. So sometimes that traversing could lead to good, but other times it could lead to bad. So that's why Elul and the people engaging with his work explore this relationship between desert, wilderness, and wasteland in the modern world, and like what this means for us. So you can be in an urban center and be in a quote-unquote desert. Yeah. Or you can be online and be in a desert, so to speak, because the urban or the online world is so often, like, metaphorically and literally a desert, a wilderness or a wasteland. And that's why Alul actually loved T.S. Eliot's poem, The Wasteland. And Amy Erickson, who's one of the contributors, gets into this a little bit, that it's operating in the background of Alul's works, including this one. And Amy pointed out that, you know, T.S. Eliot wrote The Wasteland during the Spanish flu. And sort of looking at the wasteland of modernity and, you know, ostensible civilization and, you know, human triumph and so forth. But really, is this really civilization, or is it more accurately described as a desert? Is it more accurately described as a wasteland or a wilderness? So that's the kind of way that he is defining and using desert here.
Sure. Yeah. No, thanks for that clarification. Okay. So then, so you have this essay by Alul, this new English translation, and then it, like you've alluded to, it's followed by five kind of critical essays from Alul scholars working today. So could you tell me a little bit about what those five contributors are sort of up to in those essays?
Yeah, for sure. Well, first of all, I can say that I'm biased, but I honestly really think that the contributors did some wonderful work here, because they really saw, I think, what Alul was trying to do and tried to carry it forward into our particular moment. And in that sense, knowing what I do about Alul, I feel like he'd like what he read. And so, you know, Amy Erickson and Emily Hill, they take on the technological side of this. So Amy sort of kicks it off and works with a lot of Alul's thought on technique and technology and says, you know, the desert we've made has been made by man, right? And looks at basically how the technologies we used have created this type of desert that we're dealing with now. And then Emily kind of zeroes in by looking at the phenomenon of surveillance capital and what this means for the church. And then Greg Wagenfer and Jason Hudson, they kind of take the eco-theology side of it. So if not this technological wasteland that we're continuing to build and reinforce and look to for salvation, as it were, what then? What do we do about the actual physical environment that is really struggling and being wounded under the weight of what we're building? And is there a different way that we can pursue away from this technological wasteland that we're creating? And if so, what does that look like through engagement with Alul's work? And then finally, Jacob Marquez Rollison sort of ties it all together with a reading of the story of Elijah, you know, and bringing that to bear, and ends with a pretty pretty powerful and prophetic word to sort of draw it all together. And so it all together, I think it shows the different facets of the essay, and hopefully in trying to expose the role that we've played in creating this wasteland that we're in, at least offering some constructive ways to do something in response to that problem.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, it sounds delightful. Okay, so for those who are maybe not as well, for anybody, where can they discover? Where can they learn more about you, or where can they find you?
Well, I'm not super active on social media, But
that seems fitting.
Yeah, I know. I know. I mean, part of it's just because I my life is so full at this moment. With you know, I have two little ones, and you know, a wife who's in school, and yeah. You know, work, and all that stuff. So that really consumes my time. But also, if we're talking about wastelands, I find that the social media world is that. But yeah. If I am on social media, I'm normally on Twitter, which is like the worst of the worst, at MCHL Morelli.
Yeah.
Morelli. I don't post much on there, but if I do something that I think maybe one or two people might be interested in, sure, I will post on there. And so, you know, like when this interview's up, like here's like that, my Twitter is where I would post it, and yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah. Or, you know, if anybody wants to like talk to me, they can just email me at michael.morelli, M-O-R-E-L-L-I @twu.ca.
Awesome.
And I'll, you know, if you want to talk about Alul or any of the other stuff we're talking about today, I'm happy to email back and forth. So yeah, those are, awesome. Those are my online touch points.
Nice. Do you have anything kind of in the works, anything you're working on with Alul or otherwise?
I do. So another project that emerged from some time that I spent in the Alul archives with Jerome, Alul's grandson, and I gotta say he's done a really wonderful job of carrying forward his grandfather's legacy as his dad and his uncles and aunts have got older, and just like how welcoming he's been to people like me, to say, yeah, hey, come and do this, the type of thing. But yeah, there was manuscripts actually for what Alul called a cinema club that he started after the Second World War. And it was a group of students, scholars, and anybody who was interested that would come and view popular post-war European, American, and Russian film. And they found all the lecture notes that he had for this cinema club. And so we've scanned all those manuscripts. We've transcribed them. Kelsey Haskett is currently translating them. And then once they're translated, we're going to do a volume that uses those notes to analyze the films that Alul analyzed. And basically the movies that they're analyzing are like Federico Fellini's Dolce Vita or Robert Bresson's Diary of a Country Priest, Carlos Theodore Dreyer's Days of Wrath, Sergei Eisenstein's Battleship Potemkin. So, I mean, if anybody is interested in Alul, just wanting to know what he thought about those like genre defining films, you know, is I think a value. And shows you a side that maybe you don't necessarily see of his work. So that'll be really fun. It'll be an excuse to watch a bunch of really cool post-war films and nerd out about it. So that'll be the next one with Honor Lul.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds like a very fun project.
Yeah, I know. And we're talking about actually resurrecting the Cine Club that
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so we'll see. We'll see if that happens, but the book project will be the first thing to tackle.
Very cool. Well, thank you, Michael. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I thank you for the conversation. I really appreciate it. Really enjoyable.